There's Lex Continui in Natura, which is from Immanuel Kant's time, the law of continuity in nature. There are no sudden jumps in nature. Everything is gradual. Everything changes gradually. But then suddenly we have an earthquake. How do we explain an earthquake? How do we explain, how did the pre-Darwinian evolutionists explain the fact that there is a fixed numbers of species for millions of years and suddenly there's a new species arises? How do you account for a discontinuity in nature? So Babbage used this thing with great effect to the pre-Darwinian evolutionists, to Lyell, to geologists who were struggling, particularly Lyell. And he did this in his soiree, his Saturday soirees, where the intelligentsia of London were present. Okay, there we have the soiree, and this is Babbage. This is the actual machine. This is Ada Lovelace, and that's John Herschel. The picture is a bit blurred because digital photography wasn't well developed in the 19th century. This is actually a BBC reconstruction with actors, but the real machine, which I programmed to actually operate in this thing. So this is his theory of miracles. He would have his guests surrounded by this machine, and he would set the machine to operate by a simple rule. So each time he turned the handle, the result would increase by 2. So it would go 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, and he'd keep doing this, and people would get bored, and he'd say, you know, Babbage, this is trivial. And then, you know, this is meaningless. And then suddenly, without Babbage doing anything except turn the handle, the thing would change the rule. It would jump and add 119. And these people would say, Babbage, you've broken the machine, right? And Babbage said no. And this is his argument. He said, I programmed this machine so that after 100 turns, it would jump by 119. I knew this rule. The rule is known to me, the programmer, but not to you. So a discontinuity in nature, by analogy, is not a violation of the rule. It's not breaking the rule. It's a manifestation of a higher rule known to me, but not to you. So by analogy, miracles in nature are not violations of law. They are manifestations of a higher law known to the deity, but not to the ordinary people. So that is how we try to reconcile. So we have something very extraordinary. You have a machine operating according to an algorithmic rule, which is exact and known and deterministic, producing discontinuities in its behavior that do not require divine presence outside science. And this is how we try to reconcile. And this had a huge impact on people like Lyell and others who witnessed this thing, who now had a model which meant they could, if, as it were, dispense with a god and open up the way for science to give a complete account of what was going on. Okay, I mentioned that these machines were digital machines. They're digital in two senses, but the main sense in which they're digital is that motion is discrete. They only recognize the whole numbers. So if you want to represent 2.5, never mind that, only represent whole. So a gear wheel will represent the value of a number, and this is, say, set at 2. If it moves to 3, then it represents 3. If it moves to 4, it represents 4. But all the values in between are still physically viable. The wheel doesn't automatically jump from 2 to 3. You can occupy all the positions between it, and it's stable. It can be stable in all those things. So to make it digital, you have to, like a flip-flop in electronics, it has to pass a threshold and then flip to the next value so that the transitional stages, the stages in between, are not physically stable. They're not viable. And we can see here, this is different century one, this is around design early 1820s, of a clear attempt by Babbage to actually digitize, to make in jumps the motion of this wheel. So you've got this wheel and you've got these little semicircles and you've got a roller there with an arm which is on a spring pressing against it, right? So we can look at that a bit more closely. So you can see there's the roller on a spring. And there, that's the gear wheel, representing the value of the number. So as you turn the wheel, you can see that there'll be resistance from it, and then when it reaches the top, it'll flop into the next position. That's like a flip-flop. Okay, in this particular case, the curvature, the curve of that wheel is not sharp enough to make a decisive. If it was a V, it would flip from one to the other. Like now, later he used Vs, but this is, you can see, the earliest example of Babbage attempting to digitize the thing. So wheels are not the basic logical element, which is a figure wheel, is not inherently, is not intrinsically, it's not itself digital. It is made digital by the control mechanism.
It's a first that, example of an analog digital converter.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. And it's also a pulse shaper, because it shapes, pulse shaper, it cleans up. If the thing is not, and I'll show you a video of how it works. If the wheel is not exactly in the position, that will force it into position. If it's less than a half a digit out, if the error is less than a half a digit. So we've got pulse shaping, and so that's a very, it's unmistakable that this is an attempt to digitize. So what makes the machine infallible are these control mechanisms that digitize the motion of the wheels. Now, there are times in the machine cycle where that sprung arm goes rigid and stops this wheel turning at all. And there are three separate functions for this control mechanism, which he called a lock, which I will show you a later design and show you a video of the thing actually running. Okay, so I've started the tale in a sort of, I've started the story in this kind of narrative way. So if we go now and look to get a map, a time map of actually how Babbage spent his life and what he worked on. So he was born in 1791, and his early professional life was spent doing mathematics. So by 1821, when he and Herschel had this big revelation, he had published 13 mathematical papers. And he then spent the next, up till about 1831-32, designing Difference Engine 1. That's the machine we've just looked at. He then had a new idea, and he designed his analytical engine, which is the Difference Engine is a calculator. It's a calculator. It only can do one specific set of functions. The analytical engine was a general-purpose computing engine, and he then spent till about 1847 in very intensive, furious activity designing this machine, the analytical engine. He then went back. Now, the analytical engine was vastly more demanding in design, and he had to develop sophisticated techniques to reduce the machine cycle, to make it calculate very quickly. And he then realized that he could build a much simpler difference engine. Difference engine number one had 25,000 parts, and difference engine number two, for the same power, had 8,000 parts. So he designed an engine three times more efficient than the first engine as a result of what he learned by trying to design the analytical engine. So then he spent 2 years, and that's the engine that we built, and then I'll show you that working. He then had a kind of gap where he just messed around a bit and fiddled around, tinkered and improved. And then he went back to the analytical engine in later life. So that, if you like, is a map. And these are the iconic images that we associate with these periods. So that's Difference Engine 1. All that survives, 1/7 of the engine. That's the analytical engine plan 25, 1840. This is Difference Engine 2 that he designed there, which we built, and I'll show you that working. And that is a demonstration piece of the analytical engine, a model under construction at the time of his death in 1871, which is all that survives physically of an analytical engine. We constructed this engine, and I'll spend from the original plans. Yes. It consists of 8,000 parts. It weighs 5 tons. It can calculate any seventh order polynomial to 31 decimal places, print the results, and stereotype them. And I'll show you that machine working. Okay, so I mentioned that we have a mathematician and sitting in 1822 with the first working model of a computer, and he starts speculating about the potential, the mathematical potential of these machines. And so These are some of his earliest speculations. Firstly, computation as a systematic method. Computation as systematic method. How did you solve an equation in that period? For those familiar with mathematics, you took the equation, you equated it to zero, and then you solved for the unknown. I don't know if that means, does that mean anything? Yes? Okay. Now, the idea was that analytics, the analytical, now normally what you did was, you didn't know how to solve this equation, and if you couldn't solve it immediately, you rewrote the equation in a form that was familiar for which there was a known solution. Now this was regarded as terribly, this was regarded as very proper. This is the way to do it. If you did, if you didn't, couldn't solve it, what you would do is trial and error substitution. You would put sample values in and see if they converged, right? That was regarded as inferior because it involves example. So generality and universality, the a priori rather than the synthetic, the deductive rather than the inductive, these were the values of the mathematical culture of the time. So generalized analytics and universality was what was prized. Now Babbage is coming along and saying, I can have a machine that will find the value of a function for which you do not have a general expression for the nth term. So I can find the value of an equation where you don't have an analytic solution for it. And this was regarded as inferior because it's to do with calculation, it's to do with instantiation. So computation, as Babbage realized, that the way you solve an equation now, if we go back to difference engine number one, if you go back to difference engine number one, okay, what does it mean to solve an equation? You equate it to zero, and then you change the independent variable, and when the result is zero, you have a solution. Yep. Now, what that corresponds to in this machine, every time you turn the handle, you get the next value in the table. So when the result is zero, you actually have found a root. The number of times you turn the handle tells you what the value of the independent variable is. Right? So, if you can mechanically detect the all zero state, let it ring a bell when it's reached all zero, you've got a machine for finding the solutions to equations. And you don't have to have an analytical solution, you don't have a general term for the nth term, you can find the value by machine. So computation as systematic method of solution was the first thing Babbage used for finding roots. Now if there were multiple roots, you kept turning and it would find the next root. Now initially you just had the thing to ring a bell. The all zero state rang a bell and told the superintendent, stop, there's a root. If it goes through zero, so if there are multiple roots, you keep turning, you'll get a multiple root. If there's no roots, you keep turning ad infinitum. We have Turing, halting criterion. Halting criterion of solvability for Turing, sorry, the criterion of solvability for Turing was halting. It's a suggestion, because for Turing it was a logical and much more complicated thing. But you have here the idea, the machine will halt if it finds a solution. Now later, you had automatic ways of detecting conditions inside the machine that would automatically halt, and I can show you one of those mechanisms. So, computation is systematic method, brand new, and you can only have that when the machine is automatic, when it in some sense has an autonomy with an internal algorithm that is not dependent on human intervention. He saw it as a new technology of mathematics. It could solve equations for which there was no known solution. You could find any value of a series by cranking through each cycle without a general term, without an expression for the nth expression. It was also a question of heuristics. You could discover new series. What he did was, you can see the legacy of this. You can see little wheels here on the outside. That shaft is on the outside of the machine. And you can move this wheel up and down. And it's linked through cogs to other shafts here. Now what he did with that was, he could take a number from one of these decades, so it's units, tens, hundreds, thousands going up like that, and move it, either feeding forward or feeding back in the method of differences, and produce, you'd have a rule of generation. So he could generate a new series based on internal cross connections for which there was no analytic solution. So you had the possibility of a machine that would, a heuristic machine, that would discover new series for which there was an absolute deterministic rule, but for which there was no general expression. So that was the third thing, was heuristics. And then he predicted the need for a new branch of mathematics. what he did was he did a calculation and he found that it took 35 multiplications and 6 additions. And he took the same mathematical expression and he rearranged it, mathematically identical, and he found that to evaluate it would take 5 multiplications and 1 addition, much more efficient. So he predicted that there would be a new branch of mathematics, which we now call numerical analysis, that would optimize the preparation, optimize calculations for machine computation, that would allow you, and you know, that has been okay. Okay, I mentioned cultural considerations, that number crunching was regarded as low level and was no real competition for analytics, for the generalized expressions which are prized by mathematics. And Babbage was aware of this, and he said that this work is not so much in unison with the taste which at present prevails in that science. So he's saying all this work was off-piste to suggest that there was a computation as systematic method, even though it is more systematic than the analytics that we used. It's more systematic to solve an equation like that than it is to use trial and error substitution. And yet he recognized that the cultural prejudice would be that this was inferior because it regards numerical instantiation, examples of numbers, which is against the principles, philosophy, and values of general analytics. Okay, so the general context we're looking at now is the utility of these engines. The point of that slide is, one is, I know there's a Pascaline in this museum which I would like to see. The point of these is, these predate, except that one, Babbage's work. And the point about these are manual. They rely, the algorithm is in the human being. They rely on the informed intervention of the human operator to get results. So you have to enter the results here with a stylus on wheels, over there on sliders, and over here by turning things. You then crank it. There's some algorithm inside, but not the complete algorithm. You then have to write the results down, which is transcription, and so on. So you have to enter the results correctly. There's all possibilities there. So these are not automatic, but they are what we would call mechanical aids. And the point about the automatic machine is you don't, doesn't rely on human intervention to get useful results. You crank the handle and the algorithm is built in. That is the plan for difference engine 1. So that's the difference engine, all that Babbage built up in the corner there. This is the drawing of the elevation. And this piece of the engine is just 1/7 of the engine, of the calculating section. This machine would have been 15 foot high. It would have weighed many, many tons. It had 25,000 parts, and it was so heavy, you can see it runs on rails here, on railway lines, on wheels. So this is the first portable. It weighs many tons, and it doesn't run windows. Okay, so if we look now at... this is a table, we won't go into this detail, but if you start looking at what is the utility of the engines, how did Babbage and his contemporaries try and convince other people that these engines were useful? What arguments did they use? Now, they're very difficult to isolate these arguments because Babbage always, it depends on who he's writing for. If he's writing for mathematicians, he'll emphasize the mathematics. If he's writing for political gain, he will emphasize errors. It's very difficult, actually. It took a long time to actually isolate and structure these particular aspects of utility. Because he also writes what we call compound benefits, complicated benefits that are combined with other benefits, and that's how he expressed himself. So if we look at this, if we look at the utility of the engines, if we draw a line down here, everything to the left of that line is to do with deficiencies, known deficiencies of existing techniques which are manual. So if you want, so this is how, this is the problem. There's a problem of quality, that correctness. There were errors in the table. There's a problem of supply, of quantity. How would you get a table when you needed it? You had to commission people to calculate all the rest of it. It was slow. Question of generality. Could I get any table I wanted? The correctness, there was a problem of infallibility, calculation, regression, verification, typesetting, proofreading, printing. All those issues were... So these were to do with what he's trying to correct, what the deficiencies. Now, that was the jumping off point, one thing. But his real interest was actually the right-hand part of the table, which are the new implications, the theoretical implications, which I've mentioned, heuristics, computation and systematic method, practical applications. It was labor-saving. There were spin-offs because there were new techniques, mechanical techniques he developed, The engineering of the day wasn't sufficient to build these machines, so he developed all kinds of devices. And we've spoken about computation heuristics and numerical analysis. So you can see that errors and the overemphasis of errors through Lardner belongs to this part of the table, but Babbage's actual interest, when you read his earliest speculations, before he had any idea that he would build the machine, before he tried to convince people that it was worth doing, that this is actually what interested him. This is partly what they created as a rhetoric to actually convince others that there was a usefulness to these machines. So, if we look at the historical ideas so far, we've got the idea of the autonomous machine. We've spoken about that. We've got mechanical process and a machine cycle. The idea that there's a cycle that repeats itself, and that the idea of mechanical process, inverted commas, for two reasons. It's mechanical because it's literal. The machine is made of cogs and levers, and it's mechanical in the sense of Turing-Newman. It's an unthinking process. The development of mechanical logic. So the algorithm is built into the machine. Digital logic through the discretization of motion, techniques for digitizing these things. The idea of machine intelligence is fundamental there. And computation as a systematic method, and the notion of an algorithm is built into that. So Difference Engine 1, the project collapsed in 1832, 1833, through a dispute with his engineer, and nothing further was done with Difference Engine 1. But the story doesn't end, because I mentioned that later, after Babbage, he designed Difference Engine number 2.
Was it really feasible to operate it like that?